This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. The Michigan legislature appears to be ready to make some progress on health care reform. The Democrats in the House and Republicans in the Senate have some similar ideas about helping hundreds of thousands of people who do not have health insurance now get it. Here with me this morning to talk about these proposals and other remedies for the state's stressed healthcare system are Marianne Udall Phillips. She directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan and joins us from the studios at Michigan Radio. Good morning, Marianne.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Happy to do it.
And Gary Benjamin is a health policy attorney with Michigan Legal Services. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. And I think we'll start with you, Marianne. Some of the talk around these bills does claim that if they are moved forward and become law, that hundreds of thousands of people, as I say, who do not have health insurance, would be able to get it. What sorts of folks are out there who are not covered now that might be if some of this becomes law?
Well, you know, we have about 1.2 million people in the state of Michigan who are uninsured today. And there are all kinds of people. You know, there are a lot of myths about who is uninsured. And one of the myths is that they're generally very low income and they are not working. But in fact, most of those who are uninsured are working. Almost over 80% are working. They do tend to be the sort of the lower paid working folks who are working in retail or other service industries. And they tend to be in their 30s on average, usually not in the older categories because they tend to be eligible for Medicare. So we have quite a range of people who are uninsured in the state, many of whom could be eligible for health insurance under either of these bills or under the things that are being looked at in Washington.
And what makes them ineligible would change?
Well, most of them don't have health insurance offered through their employer, or if they are offered through their employer, they would have to pay premiums that would be too high cost. So the critical issue with regard to the uninsured is the cost of health care. And for many people, it's unaffordable. They can't purchase the premiums, or they can't pay for the premiums for the individual coverage that is offered because the cost is simply too high.
So what can be done? Mandating certain ceilings for folks who come along as individuals to buy, to purchase health care or health coverage?
Well, nationally, most of the things that are being looked at to help people get health insurance coverage really would provide subsidies, would provide support, financial support for those who are poor or near poor, would require that perhaps that more employers offer health insurance, would require perhaps that individuals purchase insurance, but again, with some subsidies for those who couldn't afford it. And of course, one of the major things that's being looked at the federal level is how you reduce the cost of health care so that you make that health care more affordable.
Gary Benjamin, how do you see these proposals affecting some change in Michigan?
Well, they have a great deal of promise when you read them together. There are some differences between the two sets of bills. There's 14 total bills. We're particularly happy that they agree almost completely on establishing a catastrophic claim system, which would pay insurance companies back for claims over $25,000 in a year. That should stabilize premiums, maybe even reduce them somewhat. And that's a system that we had asked the Speaker of the House to help introduce before 2,000 people in a rally last September that Moses put on in Detroit. So we're glad that they both came out with a system that's, in that regard, is pretty much identical and would, we think, create incentives to control costs on high-end claims particularly.
So that is
then
to say you pool up
in terms of subsidies for other people statewide to subsidize health insurance generally, which would help cover several hundred thousand more people.
And where would the money come from?
Well, there's three or four sources. The catastrophic claims system money is basically recycled. It's a fee or a tax on health insurance corporations, which is then put into a fund and used to pay for the high-end claims. For the subsidies for individuals, the Senate version has a, up to a 1.8% surcharge on medical claims paid by health insurers. Both the House and Senate versions have what amounts to a tax, I think they call it a fee, on not-for-profit health insurance companies that would create an income stream. Both seem to, the Senate's explicit on this, but both seem to say they would try to expand Medicaid, which means we would get some federal matching dollars. And there is in the Senate bill a provision that would use the QAAP funds. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's a program that's in existence now that helps pay for the care for uninsured people and Medicaid people, and that some of that money could be used here. And a fifth source in the House version is there's some cost shifting going to be allowed for to cover senior citizen supplemental plans. So they've got four or five different income streams coming in, and it's unclear to me how much that would produce, but it looks like it would be in the area of $700 million or more.
And so when you say, when you talk about a surcharge or a fee or a tax, would it be expected that eventually those would be passed along to the folks who now have insurance and would show up in their premiums or their deductibles?
Well, I think that's a risk with these bills, but the theory seems to be that if you have a catastrophic claim system set up, it would stabilize premiums and at least the cost wouldn't be going up as fast as it has in the past. I don't think anybody's assuming that premiums will drop, but they've been rising in Michigan at a rate that's the second highest in the country in the last two or three years, and that really needs to be kept under control. So I don't think it'd be fair to say premiums won't go up, but with this scheme, the plan is, or the hope maybe, is that they would go down slower and that we would, in that sense, see some savings that would be also passed on. We'd like the savings, and in the Senate bill, there's a provision that says any savings created in premiums based on the catastrophic claims plan should be passed on to the consumer, and we certainly support that. We think that's almost a necessity in both these bills.
Marianne, when we talk about large numbers of people who are now uninsured becoming insured under this, are we talking about driving them to private plans or expanding Medicaid or new publicly funded coverage programs?
Well, there are lots of options that are being discussed in terms of how you cover the uninsured and different options at the federal level than at the state level. What's happening right now as more employers drop health insurance coverage is more and more citizens in Michigan and frankly nationally are being forced into the private market and they're searching for coverage as an individual. And that is the hardest coverage for people to find that is affordable. In Michigan, we have a really unique situation relative to the rest of the country because here Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan is what's called the payer of last resort. And what that means is that they cannot turn away anybody based on their health status, their age, or any other factor, which is really a great thing. And again, not true in most of the rest of the country and not true when applied to other health plans, even in Michigan. So people who are very, very sick in Michigan tend to go to Blue Cross. And of course, as more people who are sick go there, that raises the premiums for everyone. So the big issue that's being debated nationally is whether you prohibit health plans from excluding people based upon health status. And that's part of what is being discussed in Lansing with these bills. That would probably make health insurance more affordable in the individual market because what insurance is a sharing of the risk and a pooling of the cost. And if you just have sick people getting that health coverage, it makes the cost higher. You really need to have a good mix of healthy and sick people who are all sharing that cost to make it much more affordable. So the current approach in Michigan is really looking at fixing the private market with some, as Gary said, some expansions for Medicaid, some expansions for the My Child program for children in our state. At the federal level, they're looking even broader at more public programs, at certainly more expansions potentially of Medicare and of Medicaid.
So you're saying these bills that were put forward last week are mainly going to force the private insurers to open up their doors a little wider to folks who generally have not been able to get in?
Well, they do other things as well, but they certainly in the House bill at least, they do look at that issue of opening the door wider so that people who are sick and or who have high health risks are not excluded from health coverage from all health plans in the state.
I think the most optimistic assessment that I've seen is from Senator Tom George, who drafted the legislation in the Senate, and he said as many as 600,000 people who do not have insurance now could get it, and as you say, there's 1.2 million people without it. Who is likely not to be helped by what's on the table in Lansing? Who will still be left out and uncovered even if something gets done down there?
Well, it's a little bit hard to make predictions about what these bills would do and who really would be covered by the bills. And I don't know how that estimate of 600,000 was created, but we do know that there are people who might have not make the income eligibility levels that are in these bills. As Gary said, there's some subsidy for some people with certain levels of income, but there might be people who are still somewhat higher than that income level but still don't have enough money to really afford health insurance that would be left out. There could be other groups in those categories that might not be able to still afford health insurance even with the help provided by these bills.
Yeah, if I can follow up on that a little, Peter, the Massachusetts experience when they passed their reforms 3 years ago or so was that people at 400% of federal poverty level, which is $40,000 to $45,000 for an individual, really couldn't afford, in general, the health insurance. So a lot of those people receive waivers. And so it's... the people at 300% and below federal poverty level in Michigan would get a subsidy or actually free insurance in a sense. So it's the higher end folks or that probably would be left out to some degree. The House plan has a drug buying plan that's called the Gold Benefit Plan. It's a separate bill that would cover anyone in the state, and I don't think there were any income limitations, who did not have prescription coverage. It's basically more of a discount type plan, but that's another area that I think is being overlooked a little bit right now in the House plan that I really like.
Gary's point about Massachusetts is really important, and you know, I think you looked, Peter, at the report that our center released on health coverage in the state, which you can get by going to our website, which is just chrt.org. It's our Cover Michigan report, and we have in there comparisons of all 50 states. Massachusetts has the highest coverage in the state, that is the fewest number of people who are uninsured, but they still have 5.4% of their state who are uninsured, and those are the people that Gary's talking about who still can't afford it, even with all the subsidies and the other support that Massachusetts has done to make health care coverage more affordable.
Well, you're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette, and we're talking about health care reform. The Michigan legislature is taking some steps forward on this issue. The parties seem to have some of the same ideas about increasing the number of people who have health insurance in the state of Michigan. More than a million people do not. And this morning on Points North, we're talking about these proposals and other remedies for the state's stressed health care system. You could join our conversation at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. And that was Gary Benjamin, who is an attorney, a healthcare policy attorney with Michigan Legal Services. Also here with me is Marianne Udow Phillips. She directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. And joining me here in the studio is Carrie Gray. She is the Director of Marketing and Communications for Mercy Hospital in Grayling. Good morning, Carrie.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Very well. So give us a little sense of the hospital's perspective in all this and what we've been talking about, how much help that might be to the problems the hospitals are facing.
Well, I think when you talk specifically about the bills in front of the state legislature, they would help us out tremendously. Having more people in our communities that have health insurance helps us because when they come to us, we're able to actually get paid for the care that we do provide to them. And so that is really important. With the downturn of the economy, we have definitely seen an increase in what we call charity care, which is care we provide to people either at discounted rates or sometimes completely for free because they don't have health insurance and don't have other means to pay for it. So I think definitely providing greater coverage and access for more people is part of the answer in healthcare reform.
What kind of trend were you seeing prior to the last 6 months when things got took a steep nosedive? What kind of trend were you seeing in charity care?
Well, you know, specifically for Mercy Hospital Grayling, we are in a rural community. We have quite a number of people in our community that are low income. So even before the current recession hit, we've always been a hospital that, you know, a lot of years lost money or you know, was barely making a margin because we did. Our primary payers are Medicare and Medicaid. In the last 6 months, we particularly have seen an increase, and so has our sister hospitals. Mercy Hospital Grayling is part of Trinity Health, which is a 44-hospital system based out of Novi, Michigan, and they have hospitals in 7 states. And across the system, we have seen dramatic increases in bad debt and charity care in the last year, really.
Peter,
and Marianne, you look at, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that because if you take a look at our Inner Cover Michigan report, you can see that from 2004 through 2007, uncompensated care at hospitals, and that's both charity care and bad debt, increased by 68%. So hospitals in Michigan are providing now more than $1 billion in charity care and waiving bad debts or waiving copays and deductibles people can't pay. And that's just through 2007. We know when we look at the 2008 numbers this fall, the numbers will be even higher. It's a huge increase.
And how are the hospitals meeting those costs?
Well, as and Carrie can speak to this, but many hospitals around the state have frozen staff, they're reducing staff. They are truly challenged. It is an issue that is destabilizing our healthcare system, and we are concerned about it.
And Marianne is exactly right. We have we've really utilized things that any normal organization or business would do when volumes go down. You look at reducing, you know, sending people home early because, you know, that's, you know, sometimes nurses, not because we don't have the volume to take care of them. We have looked at benefits and compensation. It's really been across the board. And while we look at some of those, you know, more typical things, I guess you could say, in terms of your cost structure, we are also looking at ways to improve efficiency. So how can we do what we do now in a more efficient way and in a cheaper way? And that, for us, has really been looking at clinical workflows. It has been looking at technology. Where can we, you know, buy a software program for the pharmacy that helps us reduce errors? How can we get more information at the right time when it's needed to our nurses and doctors. And so that's part of the equation as well.
But how much, how many areas in a hospital can you work on? How far can you take working on efficiencies when people aren't paying for the services you provide?
Right. And Peter, I think you're certainly right that you can only, as a hospital, do so much. I mean, I think, Mercy Hospital Grayling, being part of Trinity Health, is a faith-based organization, and we want to be at the table with everyone. But we do realize that the answers that we're talking about, in a broader sense, will involve the health insurance companies along with hospitals doing things differently. We have to think differently, and we have to start doing things differently to find long-term solvency.
Marianne, your report notes that this problem is more acute in and around Detroit. What's happening with those hospitals? How are they managing through the rise in unpaid services?
Yes, well, as Carrie noted, it is a huge issue where hospitals are feeling enormous stress. And again, they're laying off people, they're freezing staff, freezing, their payments to for staff. And they're certainly looking for ways to become more efficient and more effective, but the issues are so significant, and it's why there is tremendous interest in what's happening in Washington to provide more coverage for the uninsured and to help out those hospitals like in Detroit, the Detroit Medical Center, who provide enormous amounts of care to people who have no health coverage. And I would add to that, one of the things that we sometimes overlook, it's not just the uninsured that put a lot of stress on the healthcare system financially, it's also the Medicaid population. Because as you said, I think at the outset, Peter, Medicaid is the lowest payer in the state, and in fact intentionally pays at rates that are really below the cost of delivering healthcare. One out of six Michigan citizens is now covered by Medicaid. That is an enormous increase over time. Medicaid was never intended to be the answer to universal coverage. And Medicaid and the legislature, with the budget challenges in our state, just cut Medicaid payments to providers by 4%. So hospitals, doctors, dentists, all practitioners will be even more challenged to continue to take care of Medicaid patients, and that's a growing segment of their population as well.
And have you seen a response to that in healthcare providers deciding not to take Medicaid patients?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's increasingly difficult for people to find providers of care. Before I ran the center here at the university, I was the director of the Department of Human Services for the state of Michigan. And that department is responsible for the foster care system in the state. All of our children in foster care have Medicaid coverage, but we had a terrible time finding, in particular, dentists who would treat our children in foster care, and dental issues are huge issues for those kids. And it's because the payments are so low, and that's a problem that's increasing.
That is Marianne Udow Phillips. She directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Also here with me is Carrie Gray, Director of Marketing and Communications for Mercy Hospital in Grayling. We're talking about healthcare reform in Michigan. If you would like to join in our conversation, you could do so at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. So, Marianne, my sense with this legislation is that this is mainly about regulating the insurance industry and kind of shifting around, I guess in this, as Gary explained, introducing some new surcharges. So there's some new money coming in to add more people, to allow more people to have healthcare insurance. But I don't, from my conversations with you and others, I don't sense that there's a lot in this to contain costs or drive them down. Could you tell me what these bills might do if they go forward to make health care less expensive in Michigan?
Well, there are a few other things, in particular in the House bill, and Gary was sort of mentioning some of that earlier, that could make care less expensive. For example, they do require electronic prescribing. There's a lot of interest in healthcare right now, and certainly the Obama administration has made it a priority to increase electronic prescribing and electronic medical records and the whole health information technology. And the issue there is that, first of all, there are errors that are created because of misreading handwriting and things like that. And so using electronic information can be safer. There can be an increase in accuracy. And it can be more efficient and quicker and link providers together so that there's more knowledge of what other providers are doing. So that can increase both quality and over time it can reduce cost. And that is in the House bill to really move down that path. Also, as Gary said, in the House bill, there's a provision to create bulk prescription drug purchasing cooperatives, which could help lower the cost of prescription drugs by purchasing in bulk so that it's cheaper than buying individually for people particularly who don't have health coverage. And then, you know, there are some things about wellness and increasing, you know, having web availability to wellness, and personal health is certainly a way to focus on reducing healthcare costs. And the House and the Senate bills do look at enabling insurers to vary their premiums based upon smoking status, based upon obesity, if there's an actuarial assessment that those things are contributing to higher premiums. And the idea behind that is to give people another incentive to stop smoking and to deal with their weight. And we know obesity is a significant contributor to health care costs and poor health status. So those things are in the bill. There are bills. There are some things that are trying to address costs, but it's not the major focus.
I want to come back to the smoking and obesity, but first I want to ask Carrie, how well connected are hospitals, say, across northern Michigan with their, you know, data, records, prescription information, this kind of thing?
That really varies by hospital. In particular, Mercy Hospital Grayling actually shares an IT system with Mercy Hospital Cadillac and Munson Medical Center in Traverse City. And the connectivity between those three hospitals is good, but could be better. And I think that there is opportunity to really look at ways that we could really expand that so that we have greater connectivity across really the region. And that's helpful in a lot of ways, and especially when you start looking at some of the sicker people. So, you know, people in the more rural regions like Grayling or even, you know, further up towards Mackinac, if you have a heart attack or you need high-end cancer care, you often end up coming to Traverse City for care at Munson Medical Center or care in Petoskey at Northern Regional Medical Center. And so getting those hospitals connectivity for their patients, I think, brings huge efficiencies that we don't currently have.
So why does the federal government or the state government need to be involved in mandating or facilitating more connectivity of hospitals? If it's efficient and makes sense and makes everything easier and cheaper for the hospitals.
Yeah. And I think that's one of those common sense things, like, why aren't we doing that? And I think we are now moving more towards that. I think why we haven't possibly been there in the past is that our situation in terms of healthcare has never quite been as bad as it is right now. So we were more able to operate in silos. And I think now, just with everything that's happened in our country and the economy in the last year, we're just realizing we simply can't afford not to have those things. So it's some extent timing.
It's also very expensive. And so the reason most hospitals haven't moved this way and certainly haven't moved between systems is because of the cost, because there haven't been national standards. So if you think back to the whole VHS versus beta or whatever it was, I forget what it was
right,
when
right.
We were watching the, you know, videotapes or whatever, there haven't been national standards. And so as people invest in their own systems and they invest in their own ways of doing things to change those so that they can link up with other providers or even link up with their own doctors is very costly and hard to do if there aren't national standards.
I, w- I Go ahead, Peter.
No, you go ahead. I'm going to go to a phone call after you.
Okay. And I was just going to say, I would agree with Marianne. It is the IT systems, you know, and I work for hospitals, so I can speak more to hospitals, are incredibly complex. And we do have, you know, we have different software programs for radiology and the pharmacy and, you know, software programs to support nursing care by the bedside. And then if you are a hospital like Mercy Hospital Grayling that also employs doctors in a primary care setting, there's electronic medical records for outpatient settings. So, you know, hospitals have never had lots of money laying around to invest in these things. And so the cost factor has definitely been an issue.
Let's take a phone call. David in Interlaken. Hello, David.
Yeah, hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, am I on the air?
You're on the air.
Oh, just a quick comment. I hear all the talk all the time, and I agree with it, about providing better health care for more people and things like that. One of the items that seems to be missed in this whole debate is the secondary and tertiary benefits of perhaps a national healthcare system would provide. For instance, if someone gets in a bad accident, you're faced with an unknown future of what are going to be the medical costs. Okay, my wife was in intensive care for 3 months. Okay, after an accident once, and then that was only part of it. But the first thing you go through your mind is helping somebody get better. But the secondary thing is, how am I going to pay for this the rest of my life, whatever happens? And I think this happens to everybody in terms of from when they're born. If something happens to a baby when it's born, who is going to pay these medical costs the rest of your life? Your insurance, is not available that will cover that, these potential costs. And I think this is, it expands if you look at, what it means in terms of legal fees or legal costs. That we have court cases. We talk about our huge settlements in America. Well, I think every lawyer, when he goes to in front of a jury, looks at, well, this is going to cost maybe millions of dollars in the future, because somebody has to pay for this, the future medical costs of this person who's been damaged by, negligence or something like that. And then, we also, in fact, in today's world, we're looking at, you've heard the story many times of people who have gone into bankruptcy and lost their houses. I mean, that sounds like the housing market thing here, because of extreme medical costs. That is a benefit that would derive if we had some system that says, wait a minute, your costs are not going to be, extreme because of something that happens to you. You won't go bankrupt. You won't have to sue somebody to collect on that. Maybe other reasons you could, loss of wages or something like that, but you wouldn't ever have this excuse of, unknown projected cost into the future.
But someone, those costs will still have to be met somehow.
Yeah, they would have to be met, but it's not, it is, as an individual, it is something that we add on to everything, okay? In other words, to cover our potential loss. You just got hurt in an automobile accident. You don't know if you're ever going to walk again or if you're ever going to get off the ventilator or something like that. Who's going to pay for that? So you go to court. They sue. They sue for what may be, 6 months of treatment or 60 years of treatment, unknown. And somebody pays for that. And we talk about, it costs so much to have medical malpractice insurance, or it costs, because we're trying to cover unknown potential benefits or costs.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, David.
Okay. You're welcome.
I think if Gary Benjamin were still here, he'd have a lot to say about this. But Marianne, maybe you could offer something on that?
Yeah, well, a couple of comments. And, of course, the United States is the only developed country in the world that does not provide coverage for all of its citizens. So we are certainly an outlier, and there's no question that every other developed country has made the calculation David's talking about, that it's better for productivity, it's better for society, it's an economic issue in other countries to provide health coverage and for all their citizens. And so there's no question that there are a lot of effects of not having health coverage that go beyond the issue of individual medical care and relate to productivity of the citizens of the country. So I think that's certainly true. On the issue of malpractice, most of the research shows that although malpractice is an issue, it is not really a significant cost driver in the system. And we've done lots of experiments in lots of states in terms of changing malpractice laws and tort reform, et cetera. And they haven't shown that that in and of itself reduces healthcare spending. So there is an issue with malpractice, but probably isn't going to be the big thing that really changes the trends on healthcare costs.
Can you tell us anything about the experience in Michigan? I think trial attorneys would tell you the Michigan Supreme Court over the last 10 years has probably done about as much as a state court could do to
That's right.
Limit the ability of plaintiffs to bring lawsuits. Were we able to measure any effects from that?
You know, I think probably, and you know, providers, particularly physicians, would tell you it's a better climate, and that perhaps it has made an impact in terms of people's willingness to work in emergency departments or as OB-GYNs or in other areas which tend to get a lot of litigation. We haven't seen a big impact or any that we can discern on the healthcare trends. Now, Michigan as a state on healthcare spending, we're sort of in the middle of the pack. We actually aren't a high-cost state relatively. We're not a low-cost state. But our healthcare trends have pretty much tracked what's happened nationally. So we're not out of line, but we're not better in that regard either.
That's Marianne Udow-Phillips. She directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Here with me also is Carrie Gray, Director of Marketing and Communications for Mercy Hospital in Grayling. You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. We're talking about healthcare reform in Michigan. If you would like to join in our conversation, you could do so at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. Marianne, I'd like to go back to an issue you brought up a little while ago, that these bills proposed in Lansing would allow insurers to adjust rates based on smoking or obesity. How? What kind of ability would it give to insurers specifically?
Well, it would enable insurers to essentially charge higher rates to individuals who smoke and or who have a certain body mass index. That's a little bit more complicated and a little less clear on exactly how it would be applied. But it would give the ability to vary the rates based upon people's health habits and their health behavior. And, you know, we'd have to see exactly how that played out in practice. But that would be included in the legislation.
And has it played out in practice anywhere else?
Well, there are some in other states. There are health plans that charge a premium if you're smokers. I haven't seen examples where people apply that to obesity, because that's just a much harder piece to measure. Some employers do, and as I think you know, there was an employer in the Lansing area who essentially terminated their employees who were smoking, even if they weren't smoking in the workplace. They were smoking in their home setting. And that was challenged, but it was upheld. So employers over time have addressed or have approached this from a carrot and a stick type approach to try and get people to adopt healthier health habits.
And has it had much of an effect on the industry overall, or is there any evidence that it might?
Haven't seen an effect on the industry overall. What we know about smoking from all the research that's been done, and, you know, we've been much more successful in this country in terms of seeing a reduction in population use of tobacco products. And, you know, that happened through a multifaceted effort, starting with, of course, the Surgeon General's report in the 1960s and going into major awareness campaigns and societal support for stopping smoking, including clinicians, communities, and others. And a very big factor in the success of the programs to stop smoking, frankly, has been an increase in taxes on cigarettes. We know that that has a dramatic and direct effect on reducing smoking. That is why, and you might have seen press coverage this week and last in Congress, they're talking about putting a tax on soft drinks and other sugar products with kind of that similar thought in mind, that it might have that same kind of effect on obesity. Obesity is really a more complicated set of issues than smoking, but we might see more heading down that path as well.
I think for a lot of people, this they perceive this as a slippery slope, and I know the company in Lansing that fired its workers would also, for over not quitting smoking, would also take blood samples of its workers and have them, you know, report family health history online and all these measures. Do we have good laws in place to protect people as we go down that path so they don't find their employer or their, you know, local government agent meddling too far into their personal life and their, you know, their medical history and other behaviors?
Yeah, I it's a really good question, and it is a very hotly debated issue, and ethicists, I think, would have significant debate, especially when we're talking about things like obesity, where their research isn't so clear that some of it's not genetic as opposed to behavioral. And you have a mix of factors with obesity, at least. We know it's probably a combination of both. And so I think it's going to be a very challenging time, and I think it's going to be a challenging legal time where there is this balance of personal rights and anti-discrimination provisions weighed against the attempts to change behavior and reduce healthcare costs. And again, we don't have a lot of research that those things work to actually reduce healthcare spending. So I think it's going to be a very complicated issue. But given the pressure healthcare spending is having on the country and on employers, I do expect more of these kinds of approaches to be taken.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Peter, I was just kind of to add to that. You know, I do believe that there's personal responsibility, obviously, in part of fixing healthcare in this country. And moving a little bit away from some of those lifestyle things or things that relate to your health status, that we've seen at the hospital is a lot of trends in health insurance companies offering products to employers that have more of a health savings account measure to them, have higher deductibles as it relates to them, so that you know, a family or an individual is responsible for their medical bills up to several thousand dollars before their health insurance kicks in. And we have at the hospital level see that change things a little bit. You know, if a person needs an MRI and that's a very expensive test, and they have to pay out of pocket for it, they do think differently about how they spend that money. Or if they have a health savings account and they're putting those pre-tax dollars into account out of their own paycheck, and they know that, you know, they put $3,000 away for themselves or their family for a year, I do think that that changes the way they look at how they spend that money, and it elevates the conversation with their providers of saying, let's do this in a way that meets my needs, but in a more efficient way. And I do think that we'll continue to see that trend as well.
We have a caller, I think, who wants to talk about this very thing. Kelly in Traverse City.
Hi. I am really excited to hear somebody finally talking about personal responsibility. From the patient's side of the story, I've been a nurse for over 40 years, and I think I can speak pretty intelligently from the medical end of the situation. And I have, through the years, gotten so irritated with people very dependent on what the system has to offer and yet being totally unwilling to take any responsibility for making their life better. There was the discussion on the cigarette smoking. It's really upsetting to have someone come in to the ER gasping for breath, reeking of cigarette smoke, saying that they are trying to quit smoking. And it just makes me wonder why we as a community are putting millions of dollars into getting these people back on their feet so that they can have another cigarette on their way home, or the diabetics who say, well, I just can't give up my Dunkin' Donuts or whatever it is. And I think we are stuck in a real mess with the pharmaceutical companies almost trying to keep people in that frame of mind where it doesn't matter what I do, I can always take a pill to make myself better. And I think where we need to put some of our money is in what, forming the minds of the up-and-coming generation so that they do not think of the magic pills as something to allow them to do whatever they want. If we can train the young kids that you know, junk food is bad for them, if we can train them that to take a pill is something that you would do as a last resort. I had a elderly woman when I I asked her if she needed her lecture on smoking, and she said no, she'd gotten them all of her life. And I said, well, apparently they're not working. And she said, I can live my life any way I want. And I wanted so badly to say, and then we, as the medical society, don't have to treat you. I mean, you know, it sounds so callous, and I really am a caring person, and you don't have to be afraid if I'm your nurse when you come into the ER. But I had a woman who was out of one of her over-the-counter medications, and she called EMS and said she was having trouble breathing, admitted to the EMS people on the way into the hospital that she just didn't have anybody that could run to the store to get this very inexpensive over-the-counter medication for her. So she decided she'd come to the ER and we could give it to her. And there was another time when some young homeless man had been sleeping on a friend's couch, didn't know where he was going to get breakfast, so he called EMS and told them that he had terrible abdominal pains, admitted to the doctor when he got to the hospital that he just wanted some food. Now, why is it that the government can give a free ride to this sort of a situation, but we cannot figure out how to take care of people who are struggling and have real medical problems, who have been doing everything they know how? I had a guy come in, was having a heart attack. He was in between jobs, and he said to me, my family would be better off if I died, because this, having this heart attack in the middle of these two jobs is going to ruin us. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the whole thing is just totally screwed up. And I'm not a political person, but I think we need to get back to the core. And I think, unfortunately, I will be dead before we see the change in the system. But I don't know who has the power to do what.
And Kelly, do you? How do you think people got this sense of complacency or dependence? Is it because of the tremendous power of science to deliver cures, or what? I mean, what caused people to look to pills, as you describe it?
God, the first word that came to my mind is laziness. And another thing, if you offer a child a carrot or a donut, which one are they going to take? If you tell some person who is really struggling to give up smoking, here's a patch or something, or here's your cigarette, which would you rather have? You know, I think we have just made it too easy for people to continue with their bad habits. No one is required to take responsibility for their behaviors. And then the pharmaceutical companies are just thrilled. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I worked in Chicago. There was a doctor who said, oh, it doesn't matter what you do. They've got a pill for everything. And I looked at him and I said, you are joking, right? He said, no. It's the whole mindset of the medical community. It doesn't matter what you do. We can give you a pill or we can cut it out.
All right. Well, Kelly, thank you for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, indicted the whole medical community. Would either Carrie or Marianne like to respond?
Well, Actually, I think she was really talking about us as a people, all of us. And I think she's right, because I think it has very much to do with who we are in this country. And I think we all have to look at ourselves. You know, we have this view, you know, we were founded as a country on this, you know, principle of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it's really very different than the way people in Europe and other countries view things. I mean, other countries understand shortages, and they understand choices, and they do understand personal responsibility in a different way. Our culture doesn't view it that way. And I will tell you, speaking as a baby boomer, I believe that many baby boomers think that death is optional and will do anything to put that, you know, at bay. And I you know, it's a cultural issue. It's a very big issue. But I think it's all of us that have to look at that.
I would agree that it definitely is a cultural issue, and those were very broad comments from Kelly. And obviously, you can't fix that in you know, one radio show or even in a month. But what I think we can do in terms of answering some of what the issues that Kelly brought up is changing the way that we deliver care. So I work for a hospital. We're there to take care of people at their sickest moments, when they have a heart attack, when they're in that car crash. But we also see those people that fall through the cracks, who have diabetes, that end up in the hospital when we really could have managed it prior to them getting to the hospital. And when I say we, I mean collectively us in healthcare. So, you know, at Mercy Hospital Grayling, we have chronic disease management programs that are grant-funded right now because there isn't payment structures out there that exist to take care of people who have chronic disease or encourage them to stay healthy. So I do think there are relatively easy things we can do to help that situation.
All right. We have 30 seconds, Marianne, if you want it.
One final plug. As a public health person, I would say to you that the biggest thing we can do to change this picture is invest in education, and particularly early childhood education. We know that has the biggest correlation with health outcomes, bigger than medical care, actually, for the long term.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. That's Marianne Udall-Phillips. She directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Thanks to the folks at Michigan Radio for providing her a studio there. Also with me has been Carrie Gray, Director of Marketing and Communications for Mercy Hospital in Grayling. So thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And earlier we heard from Gary Benjamin, a health policy attorney with Michigan Legal Services. This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Thanks to Linda Steffen and Jack Connors for helping me produce the show today. John Wunsch provided our theme. I'm Peter Payette. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.